welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen! And not a one of you is prepared for it!
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we are Drewless for the first of our Halloween episodes. We are starting with 1974's comedy Young Frankenstein, partially written, or I guess co-written, and directed by Mel Brooks.
And Gene Wilder.
Did he also co-direct, or was it Mel Brooks?
I don't know if he directed. I know that he wrote.
Yeah, most definitely. And it was a labor of love for both of them, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it was a labor of love. It was it wasn't a pure comedy, though.
Oh, no. No, it was an homage to the movie Frankenstein. Well, actually, four of the Universal Frankensteins.
Yeah.
You know, there's a book coming out about the making of this movie.
I did not know that.
Yeah, Audible, toward the middle of October, I believe.
Oh.
So
Who's it written by?
Mel Brooks, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that seems appropriate.
Young Frankenstein, a Mel Brooks book, the story of making of the film, October 18th, 2016.
Oh, so not too far away.
Okay. Actually, while we're tangenting just right after the get-go, I urge you, even if you're not a horror fan, to buy from Fangoria Music the Anthony D.P. Mann and Tony Todd Dracula. It's less than a half an hour, it costs $1.99, and it's supporting the arts. In this Halloween holiday season, please, I implore you, Fangoria Music, music with a CK, but Fangoria.com gets you there. Go to store, go to music, go to Dracula, $1.99. So Young Frankenstein, it's a horror movie you'll actually watch. It's really in the same spirit as High Anxiety.
Kind of. It's except this is done in black and white, which is I kind of appreciate.
Oh, it's great because it looks a lot. I mean, it has a lot. It owes a lot to the original Universal Frankenstein movies.
Yeah, no, it has that very old world appeal.
And, you know, Ken Strickfaden, who had the electrical machinery used in the original Universal Frankenstein films.
Loaned it to them.
I know, Mel Brooks, like, tracked him down, found out he still had it, and he gave him, like, serious credit for it.
Yeah, no, right in the credits.
Yep.
Right in the opening credits.
Absolutely. Which this is one of the, again, it's also a throwback in that all the credits are in the opening.
Yeah, it really was a great homage.
And Gene Wilder as Dr. Frederick Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
A question for you. Is Gene Wilder just a weirdo?
Well, I think the unqualified answer to that question is yes, but... what specifically are you alluding to?
Well, I ended up doing more research for this movie than I intended, but turns out I've always thought Gene Wilder was really talented, but also kind of creepy. And I think it's his soft-spokenness that adds to the creep factor for me.
The fact that he's kind of understated?
Yeah, he's kind of a soft-spoken guy, and... You don't quite... He looks like he might have bones in his crawl space.
But he gets overwrought easily.
Oh, yeah, no, and he can act on different levels. He definitely has different energy levels, too.
He has plenty of different speeds.
Yeah. So, but...
But you're saying you feel a little uneasy at his kind of undercurrent... A personality.
Yeah, he's got this undertone of creep to him.
Yeah, I think he's ultra mellow.
I mean, not like Jared Leto creepy.
In a controlled way.
Yeah.
I think he has that mellow factor, but you know, it's practiced and polished. It's a very kind of, I'm a mellow guy. No, It's fine. I'm trustworthy, and I'm fine. But you know that's simmering right on the surface of that.
Yeah, and there may be like an undercurrent of dark neurosis.
Yeah, just barely simmering up from the surface of that is a bunch of stabbing.
Yeah.
But Gilda was different in this respect. She said, I'm here for a purpose, and that's to get you to wake up and smell the coffee, not be off in the clouds someplace, listening to Mozart or Jacques Brel, but to be here with me. And when you feel anger or you feel something on your mind, you say so right now, here and now. I'm not a perfect woman that you've been searching for all your life. I'm just little imperfect Gilda. And if that's what you want, a real love, I'm your best bet. And that changed my life.
Had you been suppressing anger and...
Yes, since I was a kid.
But the character you play, that certainly the movie that really launched you, as it were, the producers, that was a character that held in the anger too, and then suddenly would burst out into manic
explosion.
Was that you?
Yes, that was me. It was a part of me. I don't like to do that so much in films, but I don't plan it out that way. If it requires it, then I do it. But that was me. It's like a tea kettle. The water boils, and if there's no little hole in the top, the pot's going to explode. And I used to play characters where it was just about ready to boil, and then you see the explosion.
Do you have, or did you were talking about suppressing yourself from the time you were a child. Did you have the ability to make people laugh when you were a child?
When I was a little boy, I mean 7 or 8, my mother had a heart attack. And the doctor said, don't ever get angry with your mom because you could kill her. Make her laugh. And that was the first time I remember consciously trying to make someone laugh. And I did. I made her laugh, and my criterion was if I could make her pee in her pants, then I knew I had done something funny. I'm not saying it for a joke. It's very true. Because she'd say, now look what you've made me do. But little boys and grown men are confident of what they do in life because of what their mothers told them that they were good at. And when I knew I could make my mother laugh, I felt I could make someone else laugh. And that's all I'm doing now, is carrying on the tradition.
I guess maybe I didn't know where I was going, which is a hallmark of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast.
It's our version of whimsy.
It is. It's definitely our version. So, the movie itself has a great cast. We get to see Madeline Kahn, easily one of our favorite actresses.
Yes.
We get to see Gene Wilder.
A very young, they're all very young, but Terry Garr.
Terry Garr, who is always great. I forget how much I like her.
Cloris Leachman.
Who is, again, superb.
And then your favorite.
Marty Feldman. But he's not my favorite. It's just that...
No, I was referring to the monster.
Oh, Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's got Gene Hackman in it, too.
Yeah, but in kind of an odd... In an odd scene.
Well, directly from the novel, that's for sure. I haven't seen the original Frankenstein in quite a while. Because, frankly, it's a little bit slow-paced. And actually, I think Bride of Frankenstein was a better movie. However, Boris Karloff is fantastic. I love him. His lispiness, even though it really couldn't project his voice as the monster. Anyway, yeah, Marty Feldman. I ended up watching a documentary called 6 Degrees of Separation, and it's the Marty Feldman story. It was basically in the early 80s. And Marty Feldman, the reason they call it 6 Degrees of Separation, after they defined that term, is that he bridged English radio with English television and then movies. And so he was like the last remaining link between all those. And it's fascinating. The whole thing is available on YouTube, and it's only an hour long. And it interviews a bunch of the Pythons, including John Cleese, who comes off as a little bit bitter. Because there's... early on, Marty Feldman was a part of a writing team that wrote for a lot of radio, and then ended up writing for this TV special that John Cleese was a big part of. And he didn't really act very much. Like, Marty Feldman was a writer, not an actor. So... Of course, John Cleese and another one of the guys had to kind of help him along with the acting, like, you know, boost up his spirit to get his acting chops down. And then who got his own TV show called It's Marty, but Marty Feldman, and John Cleese was ended up working for Marty Feldman show instead of vice versa.
Oops.
Yeah.
But I can see Marty Feldman seemed very at ease at the crazy silliness.
Yeah, he was a physical comedian. His hero was Buster Keaton.
And that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. When you watch the performance, he is unabashed and unashamed in his performance.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, he's got that goofy eye condition that came out of, a thyroid condition. He had surgery. And when he came out from the surgery, that's when he kind of had his funky eyes.
How the hell did they go after his thyroid? Through his eyeballs?
I don't know. Maybe the thyroid condition itself causes the eyes to go kind of buggy. But
weird.
But they weren't like so dramatically off kilter.
That's like, no, my appendectomy gave me hammer toes.
Yeah. Yeah, the end of the story, and again, I urge you to watch the documentary, because it's not all happiness and sunshine. He goes to Hollywood and ends up kind of following in his own hero's footsteps and doesn't have a great time in Hollywood. Like, this was his first big role, but then the next couple movies were basically just versions of this. He was the typecast goofy guy and didn't get treated maybe as seriously as he wanted to.
Yeah, I think, though, it would have been hard to see him in real serious roles.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he wanted to play dramatic roles necessarily, but I think they saw him, Hollywood saw him more of as an oddity than as a great comedic writer and performer. So, I don't know, maybe he may let fame get to his head and just couldn't come up with anything to match it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because he was in a couple of Mel Brooks movies, and he made a couple of movies on his own, which were not really well received. And then he died while filming, not Terry Gilliam, maybe Graham Clark's movie, Yellowbeard? One of the Pythons did Yellowbeard. Anyway, it's just kind of a sad story. I encourage you to watch it.
I will go look. 6 Degrees of Separation. Not to be confused with the 6 Degrees of Separation, the Will Smith movie.
Yes.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
Yep. It should go on our list at some point.
Stalker Channing and Donald Sutherland?
Don't remember. I remember Stalker Channing. I would recognize, I'm sure, the rest of the people. Because I only saw the movie once, and it was on video. But I remember it being very good. Yeah, so Young Frankenstein, as with comedies, we're probably going to have a relatively short conversation because, you know, a lot of it is shticky.
Although I laughed a lot of the sight gags and a lot of the goofy stuff. There were some little details in the background that I noticed this time around that I didn't notice the first time. First of all, I'd forgotten Gene Hackman.
I think there was a gargoyle that was supposed to look like Mel Brooks.
that wouldn't surprise me. But I wrote that this movie was full of puns, so it should have been right up your alley.
Oh, yeah. No, it is full of puns.
It is puntastic, starting with a roll in the hay, which wasn't really a pun, but, you know. In the opening of the movie, as Gene Wilder is parting with his love, Madeline Kahn, at the train station, they have the kinky elbow goodbyes, which, you know, is repeated or stolen from, I guess, from Rocky Horror Picture Show. So
this Rocky Horror stole it from Young Frankenstein?
No, Young Frankenstein's after Rocky Horror, I believe, right?
74. When is Rocky Horror?
I thought Rocky Horror was 75. So Rocky Horror stole it, yeah.
Well, of course, Rocky Horror was a stage play first, so God knows. It could have been in the zeitgeist of 1975.
It could have been. It could have been just a common thing, is the kinky elbow sex. I don't know.
Yeah, could have been. So, there's all the Mel Brooks kind of sticky jokes, like Frankenstein. And mm-hmm. So Igor becomes Igor, just as bitterness.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frodwick?
No.
Frederick.
Well, why isn't it Frederick Frankenstein?
It isn't. It's Frederick Frankenstein.
I see.
You must be Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
But they told me it was Igor.
Well, they were wrong then, weren't they?
That whole, you know, when he's walking down the steps from the train station, walk like me.
Yes, walk this way.
Walk this way with the mini cane.
Yeah, and I think Mel Brooks thought that was too cheesy a joke, but the audiences loved it, and the cast loved it. I guess the screening, when they did their dailies or whatever, they loved it. So he's like, okay. There's actually a funny story from Gene Wilder that I'll insert here.
Every Saturday night, I would watch the Marty Feldman Comedy Machine. So when I was writing the part of Igor, formerly Igor, I was thinking of Marty. A scene that we thought was going to be fireworks was Madeline Kahn arriving in Transylvania, arriving at the castle, and it was falling flat. We couldn't figure it out.
Darling.
Darling!
Surprise!
And Mel was deep in thought for a little while, and he said, Marty, when Gene says, Igor, help me with these bags, you say,
Igor, would you give me a hand with the bags?
Certainly. You take the blonde, and I'll take the one in the tavern.
Oh. Marty, inspired by the moment, bit off the tail of this fox fur that Madeline was wearing around her neck, and it stuck in his mouth. And we had to play the rest of the scene looking at Marty with a tail, a fox tail in his mouth. And if you look closely, you can see some of us breaking up at that.
Stop that!
God!
It seems like they had a lot of fun making this movie.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems, you know, like Abby Normal, that's pretty hilarious. I guess Peter Boyle, oh, another thing, actually, here's another sad thing from the Marty documentary, is he made a joke, but it also was sort of sad. He's like, you know,
Peter Boyle, who plays the monster in it, was called for 2 hours makeup. I arrived in the morning and I said, you don't need any makeup. To play a freak, that's what's so humiliating. 5 minutes, you know, just a bit of eyes.
Yeah.
They had to pretty me up to play a freak. It was terrible.
But, you know, Peter Boyle was the one that came up with what the monster sang during putting on the Ritz.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
Which is great. It's the funniest part of the whole movie as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah. And it's so absurd and I shouldn't like it, but it's just funny.
It shouldn't be funny, but it works.
Exactly. Yes.
But that's the genius of Mel Brooks in the context of the movie. If you even if you take it out of the movie, though, it's funny. If you play that clip for somebody, it's still funny.
Oh, yeah.
It's funnier in the context of the movie, but it stands on its own as a funny part.
You know, that's the other good, you know, good thing about the like essence of comedy is, you know, Gene Wilder plays his role pretty straight. You know, I mean, Igor, it gets to be kind of fun and, you know, like winking at the camera. But Gene Wilder has to be sort of the straight man in the whole thing, even though he does some absurdist stuff, too.
Oh, sure. But, you know. He's also blind.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, Gene Wilder is what I'm saying.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I probably said Gene Hackman. Yeah.
Gene Hackman.
I think Gene Hackman was in the movie because he ended up playing tennis. He was a tennis player with one of the guys. I don't know if it was Mel Brooks or one of the other people there. They happened to play at the same tennis club.
Okay, that's a qualification for movie casting?
Yeah, it's just, you know.
I guess in the 70s.
Yeah, it's not a casting couch as much as it's, you know, you jump over the casting net. Oh, and it, of course, you know, we talked before about Frau Blücher. And evidently, Blücher is not glue. It's just a very common name, like Jones or something. So Mrs. Jones. And so the fact that the horses whinnied all the time was kind of left to speculation. Cloris Leachman said that Mel Brooks told her it was supposed to be glue. That's why the horses whinnied. But that apparently is not correct. We'll have to wait till the book comes out and find out for sure.
I would speculate it's because it's supposed to be she was so mean and scary that anytime they would say her name, they'd be terrified. That's what I just assumed.
And can I point out that from the opening credits throughout the whole movie, because there's some violin music that plays an important part in the plot, but the music in this movie is great. It's gorgeous. It's got a gorgeous score.
It does.
Yeah. I was pretty impressed.
The music was also integral to the story.
True. True.
I mean, you couldn't have half-assed it, I don't think, very well. But also, it leads a lot of drama to this. The music made it a much more dramatic escapade. So it was hard sometimes watching it because it had some funny parts, but it's kind of a really sad movie.
And it's shot so much like a horror movie, you know, saying that it's lit as a perfect black and white movie, in that it's got lots of shadows and creepiness of a horror movie.
Yeah, it's dark.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It has some serious themes to it, you know? I mean, in the movie, the original Frankenstein, or the novel, you know, is kind of like about man trying to play God and how arrogant that is and how the monster doesn't want to be a monster. And, you know, in the book, the monster is highly educated, learns how to speak, reads, all that stuff. And in the movie, you don't really get to see any of that. The book is much more of an intellectual exercise than the movie is. But in this movie, you know, like Dr. Frankenstein, you know, he is actually running away from his past, his family. And at the end of it, he basically accepts his family. But of course things still kind of go awry from trying to play God.
There's a parable in there.
But you've got the funny German townsfolk like Inspector, Transylvanian townsfolk like Inspector Kemp that has the monocle over his eye patch.
And the mechanical arm.
Yes. And, you know, Peter Boyle as the monster does a good job. You know, again, you don't get a lot of, there's not a lot of room to move around in that role. But yeah, everybody does really well. I think if I remember correctly, and I don't have these in my notes, but I think both Madeline Kahn and Cloris Leachman were both up for awards in this movie. Much like Al Pacino, I think Cloris Leachman...
A Best Actress in a Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical, Cloris Leachman. Best Supporting Actress, Madeline Kahn.
Yeah, okay, and I think Cloris Leachman had less screen time than Madeline Kahn did.
And then the Academy Science Fiction Fantasy Horror Film won for Best Horror Film. Marty Feldman won for Best Supporting Actor. Mel Brooks won for Best Director.
And these are Academy Awards, or these are...
Well, the second one was the Golden Globes.
Oh, Golden Globes, yeah.
But the Science Fiction Awards were the Best Horror Film.
Oh, absolutely.
And then Hugo Awards, it won for Best Dramatic Presentation.
What were other horror movies from 1974, though? Halloween, when was the original Halloween? 1978, okay, so... Never mind then. So 74, was that like Last House on the Left time? That was 72, right?
So the other nominees for Best Horror Film, so this was classified as a horror film.
Yeah, the like a horror nominees, comedy and not a comedy horror.
Yeah. Old Drac, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Phantom of the Paradise, Bug, and Black Christmas.
Well, Black Christmas, that is a wacky movie. That actually has Margot Kidder in it. Wait, Black Christmas was directed by the same guy who directed the Christmas Story, right?
Bob Clark?
Yes, Bob Clark directed A Christmas Story.
Yes, he did. And Porky's.
And, by the way, guess who is in Black Christmas? Pierre Doulia. It was Dr. Dave Bowman in
2001.
A Space Odyssey. Banana.
Well done. Other science fiction films from that year, Rollerball, A Boy and His Dog, and The Stepford Wives.
Wow. Those are pretty substantial movies, actually.
Best advertising winner, Jaws.
Yeah, well, Jaws. Have you seen Jaws?
Best makeup winner, Young Frankenstein.
That makes sense. Yeah, Jaws is a legitimately scary movie.
It is.
I mean, not only is it disturbing if you ever plan to go swimming again, which is not the case for me, but it's got jump scares, it's got serious tension, and it's got that great speech about the Indianapolis.
Well, and it's got the animatronic shark.
Yeah, but you don't see it very often, so it makes it even scarier.
Yeah, no, because your brain does it all. It's very Hitchcockian.
Oh, that one jump scare with Richard Dreyfuss in the scuba when he sees the skeleton in the boat?
Yeah.
That is frightening.
No, there's lots of frightening stuff about Jaws. And Roy Scheider does a great job.
I think it's
underrated. It's hard to rewatch, though, at least for me. I've seen it twice. I saw it when I was really little, and then I saw it once again, I think, probably when I was just maybe 12 or, I want to say 12 or 13, maybe.
We should watch it again, maybe come summertime.
Maybe. But I remember watching 10 or, I don't know. I must have been younger because I just remember seeing it on a little black and white TV in my bedroom, and like I didn't sleep for days.
Oh, yeah.
And then I didn't want to take a bath ever.
Yeah, no, I remember between Jaws and then when those Time Life Shark books came out. I remember we were in San Francisco for the summer, and man, I had to check the pool for sharks every day.
I was like, what other movie really stuck with me? That stupid Phantasm book. I couldn't, or movie, Phantasm, that really bugged me.
With the ball and the big toy?
Yeah.
That is, you need to rewatch that because that is a trippy, weirdo movie.
I don't know if I could rewatch it.
It's like a fever dream kind of movie. I don't think it holds up. I don't think you'll find it scary. I think you'll just find it bizarre. There are some people that really love that movie, but I think it is wacky.
I just remember it scaring the shit out of me as a kid. So
yeah, sure.
This little crazy metal ball that drilled into people's heads. So, and then there's this other movie where I think like cockroaches infested people trapped in cars and stuff. That's all I remember. It's like some kind of movie where cockroaches take over everything.
Yeah, it's like a post-apocalyptic movie.
Is it?
Yeah.
I just remember
a
scene where
TV movie too.
It may have been. I just remember the scene where somebody's like in a car or automobile and they come like just flooding into the car.
Yeah. I want to say, oh man.
So IMDb has pointed me to Damnation Alley.
Yes, Damnation Alley.
But I don't know if that's it. It doesn't look right, but
it's got that like armored van kind of car.
Yeah.
Like RV kind of thing.
I don't remember that, but...
Because the only other cockroach thing I can think of course, that part of Creepshow.
No.
But there's no cars involved in that.
Yeah. But good God, the cast.
Of Damnation Alley?
Yeah, Jan Michael Vincent, George Peppard, Paul Winfield.
Jackie Earle Haley.
This just sounds crazy.
Yeah.
It had a $17 million budget.
What was the box office on that?
Eight.
Well, I'm sure I must have seen it as a TV movie.
And then $4 million for rentals. So it still didn't make it.
Yeah, well, that's hilarious.
Yeah, I'll have to take a look and see if that's it. Again, that's one of those. But insects are one of the things I can't handle in movies. I can handle a lot of things.
Oh, no, I feel the same way. It's like, I remember watching in the theater Arachnophobia. And it was just funny enough to be successful, but it also was legitimately creepy because it would make your creepy crawly, you know?
Oh, yeah. I worked at the theater during Arachnophobia, so.
You were immune to its charms?
No, we did bad things.
Oh, okay.
We would throw plastic spiders out the porthole windows into the movie theater.
Oh, that's hysterical and wrong.
I mean, I didn't. I would never do something like that, but, you know.
Well, of course. Nah. Are you kidding? Drew and I's juggling partner. One of our things we look for at the store was plastic ants and plastic flies for when they did pap smears.
Yikes.
Pelvic exams, yeah. So, I mean, I hate to give a short shrift, but anything else on Young Frankenstein? It's definitely worth a watch. This is the Halloween season coming up, so it's the season for, you know, horror movies. I don't even consider this a horror movie as much as, like, an homage to the Universal horror films. And just fun. I mean, just it's got all our favorite Mel Brooks actors.
Yeah, all the regulars are present in this. There are a couple parts in the movie that are, you know, that stand out as hilarious, which we'd already discussed, the Peter Boyle tap dancing scene, song and dance scene.
Oh, it's hysterical.
The grave robber scene is awesome.
Absolutely.
And then the slapstick that ensues when they've got the body and they're trying to get it back. But also his kind of, you know, the professor's crazy kind of fever dream, where he ends up in this, almost this musical, you know, destiny, no escape from death for me.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple really great performances. And then in Terry Garr doing some very, you know, she's very serious in some points. So, they could have made her be much, much more of like a dumb bimbo, but she's actually a really strong, smart character.
Well, yeah, she's just a good actress. She and Madeline Kahn do great, because even though their characters are a little bit wackadoo, it's just fun, and they pull it off, because they go with it. Let me see, there's one quote in here that I wanted to... Just little things. When Friedrich Frankenstein says, "Damn your eyes," to Igor. Igor to look at the camera and says, "Too late."
Yeah.
It's very sad. It's just... It's silly stuff. Some of the silliest things are some of the most fun, and some of the things that kind of like live along. Silly things like when they're at the huge castle doors, and Frankenstein says, "What knockers?" And Inga says, "Oh, thank you, doctor."
Now, there's a lot of that Mel Brooksian. That's the Mel Brooksian humor.
Yeah, so Young Frankenstein, highly recommend.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. It's... I think more today, it's more of a, I mean, it's comedy. It's a dramedy. It's got some comedy and some drama. I don't think of it as a horror movie, though. In no way do I think it's scary.
No, it's a science fiction movie at best.
Yeah.
It's got the horror elements because of just the black and white and the feel of the original Universal horror movies. But yeah, it's a straight up science fiction plot.
Also, maybe looking back to the prism of, you know, 1974.
True, but because it's a period piece and like an homage to the 30s, I think that turns it into timeless somehow. Somehow the math works.
No, all right. Perhaps.
So, any housekeeping? What did you think of our Man with the Golden Gun episode?
I laughed.
I couldn't believe I found Hervé Villechaize singing.
That cringe-inducing song for that poor, poor man.
And I could not find any video of him in Venezuela, so I have no idea what kind of crazy fever dream that was, but...
Probably involved Eric Estrada and chickens.
Must have. Did you enjoy Christopher Lee's heavy metal...
Charlemagne? It was terrible. I had to pause it. So, I've just spent 2 days at the coast, the beach. It's storm season, so I like to go to the beach. So boyfriend Jesse and I went to the beach for a couple days. We took off. So I'm listening to the podcast in a hotel room. And we have a nice room. I'm listening to the podcast to my little Bluetooth speaker that's blaring out in the hotel room. And this Charlemagne just comes roaring out of the speakers. And I thought, good God, these people next door in the other hotel rooms really think I am a crazy lunatic.
After hearing Hervé Villechaize.
Why?
Do people have to fight?
Yeah, I felt bad for him. Who thought that was a good idea? That poor, poor man. I feel bad for him, and he's dead. That's a publicist doing. That's somebody like, no, this would be great for your career.
Oh, no,
this.
He was on a lot of things like The Love Boat, and this is the Merv Griffin Show. He was on Dinah Shore. He was on all those shows at the time. He was on American Bandstand, and I think because he was a fan of Crystal Gayle, maybe? I don't know.
Perhaps.
I mean, it was weird. I think he was... on one show, he was wearing a cowboy hat and had a shirt, like a t-shirt, with written in rhinestones that said, like, Disco Midget.
Oh, jeez.
Which is all you need to know about how sad that period of time was, but oh well.
It was a very different time. Well, Charo was on Love Boat how many times? Like a million times, I want to say.
Did you know that Charo is an exceptional guitarist?
Yes. She's have you not seen her perform?
I have recently, yeah. I mean,
she's amazing.
Person, but yeah, she is.
And she's still amazing.
With those nails.
And, you know, it's amazing still that she, I mean, she's clearly had a little work done, but she still looks good.
Oh, yeah.
And she's still funny.
Well, that's the thing, is I didn't appreciate the charm.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't just all coochie coochie coo. She had serious stuff going on. She had chops, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I have actually any other housekeeping, really. So what housekeeping did you have?
Well, I had a TV recommendation, which comes at a time in my life where I probably wasn't in a really good headspace to be watching it, but it's a really good show. Have you heard of Mr. Robot?
I've just heard of it. Is Christian Slater in that one?
Yeah. I'd had the entire season saved up on my DVR. I mean, it just got over a couple weeks ago, and it's so good that me and my wife actually like marathon most of it over this long weekend here, which doesn't happen to us anymore because it's very difficult for us to watch concentrated TV, but it was really good. But also it makes you crazy because the main character is kind of a nutcase. And I think you would like it because in my mind, it's sort of like what Rubicon would be if it was about millennials and Will Travers was, everything was told from Will Travers' point of view, and he was crazy, and he was an unreliable narrator.
Okay, sold.
Yeah, so it was really good, but yeah, it made me question my own mental health because I'd come across a couple articles that I've read that have made me feel like a crazy person. Like, have you heard of misophonia?
I don't think so.
If I were to describe it to you, I bet you would say, yeah, that sounds like something you have.
No pressure.
Misophonia describes a set of symptoms where people are triggered by certain sounds. And depending on the level of severity of misophonia that you have, it depends on your reaction to these trigger sounds. But it can just be, it can range from like annoyance to like panic attack inducing.
Like Hulk-like rage?
Anger is a very common reaction. And common sounds that trigger this include like sounds of chewing or crunching or smacking of lips or sniffing or snorting. So all these things that really bother me and have always bothered me.
Is it genetic directly from dad?
Coughing is another one. The article I was reading was talking about how this is kind of this new thing that psychologists are trying to figure out, and there's some disagreement about whether it is just kind of a learned behavior or if there's some people that think there is some correlation to OCD type tendencies. But at the same time, I was like, oh, I feel like it's really a relief that this is a thing and I'm not like just this super sensitive asshole about that kind of stuff. Or at least that's why I'm a super sensitive asshole about this kind of stuff. And so that was a relief. But also, I was like, but it made me start to question, like, other things that I do in my life. Like, is it all under one umbrella of, like, some mild form of mental illness? It was also at the same time I read another article which talked about how people who are hard to read, you know, like poker face type people, are inherently unlikable, because it turns out that when people can't judge what you're feeling or don't get any sort of signs, nonverbal signs from you when they're interacting with you, it makes them uncomfortable and not like you, which is, you know, another phenomenon that I have experienced often in my life. So that sort of articulated something that was kind of rolling around in my head for a long time. And that explained it. But then so the misophonia, the OCD thing, the weird social interaction thing, that all started to jumble up in my head, and I started paying more attention to things I do. You know, like walking around like a tile floor. I assume everybody steps over the lines because, you know, that's what you're taught as a kid. But then it occurred to me, maybe everybody doesn't like mentally project extensions of lines, like from corners, and also make sure they step over those. I don't know. Maybe that's a thing. Maybe not. And then the one that really sent me over the edge was we have vending machines in our break rooms where I work. And I have a very generous employer who provides free sodas in these vending machines. So you don't have to put any money in. You just go dial up the number of the soda you want.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's great. It is quite a perk. So, like, every afternoon, I go grab myself a Diet Pepsi. And I like my routines. So I always have one. There are like three rows that have Diet Pepsi in them. So there's like Diet Pepsi, some Diet Coke, Diet Mountain Dew. You know, there's a variety, but there are three rows that have Diet Pepsi. And the one I always go to is 141, and I like that because it's the number's a palindrome, and that I like that kind of thing. And I don't know why this happened. This is, I mean, occasionally they'll be empty, like it's time to refill the vending machine, so no big deal. But what really kind of fucked me up is I went there, and that just that one row was empty, and it was really disconcerting to me. Like, the row on either side still had Diet Pepsi in it, and I was like, 141 is empty. And then I looked at the one next to it is 140. That's not a palindrome, so I don't really like that one. And the one next to it is 143. And that was freaking me out, because what happened to 142? And, right? This is crazy. And then I was like, well, maybe 143 is a cool number. Maybe it's a prime number. But that doesn't make me crazy, because that is just a callback to my youth, where I saw Bill Brownfield do that. Look at the concert ticket stub. So that's just like a learned behavior that I try and figure out if it's a prime number. So I'm like, all right, I can go with 143 because that's cool. But then as I punch it, I'm getting it out. I'm like, fuck, it's not a prime number. It's actually 11 times 13. God damn it. And this is like really causing me anxiety. And then I start to wonder if there's anybody around like watching me go through this. And so all of these things are happening like within the span of a couple days, while we're watching a TV show called Mr. Robot that makes you feel crazy when you're watching it. And I was like, fuck.
Wow.
So, yeah. That's why I wanted to wait for until the end for housekeeping.
Yeah.
Sorry. I didn't actually intend for this to turn into a therapy session.
No, that's okay. Because luckily, I have nothing to add. But again, like the podcast, any advice I give you is not burdened by any kind of knowledge or research on the subject matter.
Right. And you're no stranger to like anxiety.
Oh, no. But the beauty of my anxiety is that even though there are certain things that used to trigger it, and maybe still do, it's hard to say, because every time I say, oh, I'm cured, then, you know, it'll crop up again. But for me, the problem with anxiety wasn't just the panic attack thing. Once I figured that out, that was a lot easier, but was because how stupid I felt. that, you know, and maybe, I mean, that's kind of what you're describing too, you know, because the little scenario that runs through your head as you're looking at the soda machine is one thing, but also being consciously aware of it and how it must look to outsiders is a whole different thing, because that'll affect your mood. And yeah, so I don't.
And it did.
Well, exactly. And you start to wonder. I don't know. It's weird because I don't have obviously the same thing. And at first I was going to say something sort of smartass, like, wait, you're going to say that if I know that you dislike that I crunch Doritos in your ear on purpose, that when you punch me as hard as you can in the sternum, I should feel sorry for you because you're actually a victim. It's like, what? I got punched in the sternum. It's for being a dick, but still.
Wait, did that actually happen?
No, you could hurt somebody punching him in the sternum.
Well, both parts of that story seem very plausible.
Yeah, well, it's true, though. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, because that's what I do, is if I know something irritates somebody, and you know this well, that's the benefit of being an older brother. That's just one thing to file away for later. Although I'm much more conscious of it now, and I'm very careful. Because as it turns out, when you're young and stupid, and this is why I try to give young people a break sometimes. And by young people, I mean like people in their early 20s. It's like, okay, so you're physically mature and you're worldly enough to be able to get by. And in some cases, you know, if you're a full grown adult at 26 and mature, man, good for you. There are plenty of people that aren't. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that if you're anything like me, you think you know it all. But it turns out you don't know anything and you have no experience and you also have no way of sensing the importance of individual things. Like some things are very important, but as it turns out, not everything is very important. And quite often, how other people, or I guess what other people think of you is not important, but that's a whole different deal. It's not necessarily not important. It's just I do believe that other people's opinions of me is none of my business.
True. But being a parent also, that, you know, having the responsibility of trying not to screw up your children just adds a whole another layer of complexity.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, you know, for instance, there comes a point when you're just happy your child is eating.
Yes. Like,
you know, you're happy that they're actually eating with a sufficient volume of something that maybe is kind of healthy. Like that's all you want. So if I am like blinded by rage that they're eating really noisily with their mouths open, I don't want to infect them with my crazy by, you know, yelling at them to keep their mouth shut while they chew. So then, you know, the only way to cope is to just kind of shut down, and then you're not present. So, you know, you're screwing your kids up in another way. And oh, man.
Okay, well, I have a little example. It's not sensory like that, although I can hear it from down here. If it were to happen right now upstairs, I would know it was happening and it would irritate me. But it's my daughter will open the refrigerator. And usually it's because she's bored and maybe hungry, but mostly she's probably bored. And so she wants to go eat something, which is, of course, you know, a battle that that both myself and my wife face. So we're already trying not to infect her with that and losing that battle. But it irritates me to no end when you tell her, get out of the refrigerator. And she, first of all, will not even pause. And then you'll say, get out of the refrigerator. And she'll say, but I just want, and it's like, no, you have to get out of the refrigerator now or I will choke you out. And I'm thinking this, I'm not saying this, but yeah, but by the 14th time, or actually just now by the second time it happens, if Kelly's in the same room, I'll just look at Kelly and I'll be like, I want to yell at her, but I can't. And so, you know, sometimes Kelly will yell at her and sometimes it's like, I don't know what we're going to do. You know, I even thought today at work, I idly thought, what if we got her own refrigerator in her bedroom, a little tiny refrigerator? That way she could go and open it and close it and open it and close it, open and close it to her little heart's content.
I do love the aspect of being married when you have that non that nonverbal shorthand with your spouse where you can just look at them and communicate, you need to take care of this because you're the sane one right
exactly,
now.
Exactly, yeah. No, and it definitely is a trading off process.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, here, I'll give you brotherly advice. It's my experience, which is gets me out of all liability usually. In my experience, everybody is on every spectrum. So if you're slid down far on one end of one, sadly, you're still on another one. Just you may just not notice it being odd because everybody you hang around with is also on that same part of the spectrum. But yeah, as you're describing,
sure.
As you're describing the blind rage of sounds, I think not first of you, although the chewing thing, that is top of list because I would never do this to Dad on purpose like I would to you. Although maybe these days, briefly. Although maybe not. Is it nature? Is it nurture? Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? But yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Robot, it's really good, but make sure you're feeling good about your mental health before you watch
it. Okay, will do. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.